People need a translation of the energy or climate narrative to things that they can relate to.
Are you interested in the second and third-rate consequences of better energy management? What do you think about scope 1, 2, 3 emissions? How can we spread information better? Stay tuned for answers from Ellen Pierce.
What is the future for cities?
Do you want to learn more about them?
Do you want to know how others think about them?
Do you want to be part of the conversation?
Then this is the right place.
Welcome to What is the Future for Cities podcast. Today, I will interview Ellen Pierce, one of Australia's leading energy efficiency experts. We will talk about his vision for the future of cities, re-greening of cities, urban viability, neighbor, and many more. So let's start with a proper introduction. Ellen Pierce is one of Australia's leading energy efficiency experts. He has worked in the sustainable energy and environmental fields since the late 1970s and been an expert advisor to federal, state, and local governments across Australia, as well as business organizations, community groups, and the private sector. His work spans all sectors of the economy, education, and community action. He has been involved in low-carbon urban design and green building projects, program and policy development, including building energy regulation, energy and climate rating of buildings, design of appliances and equipment. He is a senior industry fellow at RMIT University and a fellow at the University of Melbourne. Ellen has received many awards, including being made a member of the Order of Australia in 2009. And with that, Ellen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for your time. I highly appreciate your appearance on the podcast. Let's jump right in. What does the future of cities mean to you?
Well, cities are already very varied, and I think they're going to become more varied because I think all cities are facing lots of disruptive change. And of course, disruptive change can be positive, negative, or both. So from that point of view, it's an amazing time, I think. From an energy perspective, because I work a lot on energy and climate issues, again, there's a revolution going on. We are transforming as rapidly as we can from fossil fuels to not just renewables, but efficiency and smart and flexible management, as well as the electrification agenda playing out. And of course, a lot of people who talk about electrification forget that a lot of the benefits of electrification actually come from improved efficiency, because it is possible to inefficiently electrify. We've seen plenty of that in the past, actually. That's one of the reasons why we used to encourage people to switch to fossil gas, because a lot of the electric technologies were both inefficient and expensive. So I think that's an interesting thing. I think there's also really a lot of uncertainty about where population in urban areas will go. And this is where, in theory, global population has to stop growing, but also the flexibility for different lifestyles now to be pursued in rural areas, around urban fringes, or a bit of both, as well as in urban areas. I think we have far greater potential to live better lives wherever we live, not just in cities. So I think that's going to be a big factor. They're the kind of things that stand out to me.
What does the city mean to you? What does the city and the urban lifestyle mean to you?
For me, it's about people and networks. It's about the serendipity of conversations or experiences that accidentally happen, you know, that sort of come together in remarkable ways. It's also about cities do have a lot of infrastructure. And that infrastructure is not just physical, it's social and financial. And that's all really important. Cities have governance structures. And again, there's pluses and minuses here in the sense that what I found with the work I did with the APEC, the Asia Pacific Economic Community, was that a lot of cities were frustrated because they didn't have enough power and the state governments or the federal governments drove things, or they didn't have enough money. So they're limitations, but at the same time, they are close to the people and close to the businesses. so that they have insights and capacities to perform governance in ways that are really important to people.
What does the urban lifestyle implies, which is different from the rural lifestyle?
And in fact, that's the interesting thing, going back to my point about not knowing where things were going with urban population. We know that, for example, Australia is, I think, one of the most highly urbanized countries in the world, even though we've got all this open space. But the issue really is that there are a lot of downsides for a lot of people around the world who are living in cities. So you have a lot of traffic congestion, air pollution and other forms of pollution, high rents if you're renting. So there are a lot of downsides to urban life, but the positives that I talked about earlier often outweigh them clearly because lots of people move to cities. But I think what's interesting now, and I think the COVID experience has accelerated change between cities and rural and regional areas now. So for starters, it's accelerated the virtual lifestyle and the virtual delivery of health services and education and a whole lot of things like that. And just going on the number of scammers we've got on the internet, clearly you can run a business from pretty much anywhere now. So the traditional image of a lot of rural people working hard on the farm and not having the capacity to engage in the leading edge of commerce has all changed. So certainly in Australia, we've seen things like there were a lot of vacant apartments. So a lot of empty nester households have sold up their largish home because lots of people want an office space and more space for their family and things like that. So they've been able to sell those and buy a small apartment in the city and a country place, and they have the flexibility to come to the city for a major event and stay overnight and, you know, all sorts of things like that. And likewise, a lot of people are now crowding onto intercity trains or from country areas to city because they're only coming into the city to work for a couple of days a week. And they can tolerate a longer time on transport for those times. So it's going to be harder and harder to define who lives in a city and who lives in a rural or regional area because a lot of people will be doing a bit of both.
Does this mean that the difference is getting murkier and at some point you think that there won't be any difference?
Well, I think they offer different things. A city is a focal point for people and business and excitement and all sorts of special occasions. And I know myself from, with say, work, even though virtual work can be very handy, I mentioned the sort of the serendipity of, you know, bumping into someone in the kitchenette at work and you talk about something and you go places that you wouldn't have gone on a virtual system or things like that. So likewise, I think if we can take some of the population pressures off cities and come up with better solutions to transport and things like that, then living in a city can become much more attractive for a lot more people because you'll have people, you'll have enjoyable quality spaces where you can recreate and you'll be able to go to all these big events. Because again, what we're seeing, certainly in Melbourne where I live, is that the city is really buzzing on evenings and weekends in a way that I think it might be busier than it was before COVID. So we're shifting the emphasis. And I think this is where, if it does mean that we can take a bit of the pressure off cities, we can invest more in quality open space and regreening and a lot of the things that people are wanting. We're seeing, again, the resurgence of dining outdoors and enjoying time together. I don't see cities disappearing or anything like that, but I think with a bit of luck, they could become better places to be. And also, if there's not quite so much pressure on housing in or near the city, that might help with reducing the prices of renting or buying because, again, we pay a very high premium for land that is well located. So if well located doesn't quite mean as much in the future because we have virtual solutions for us as well as the physical movement, then, you know, cities can have a great future.
That's reassuring that you believe in a great future for cities.
Well, I can't guarantee it.
That's fair, but it's a good start that we can believe in that. That's really good. You started off your answer for the first question, what does the future of cities mean to you? with saying that cities are varied and thus their future will be varied as well. Are cities varied currently, and are we moving in a direction which celebrates those differences?
I think very much so. The difference between a developing country major city and a developed country major city is pretty big. So that's a spectrum. But also, what is that each city interacts with its kind of watershed, the surrounding areas and things like that. So, for example, when I was in Seoul in South Korea, I was amazed at how many greenhouses they had, and they were obviously producing a lot of their food locally. Whereas in my city, we import everything from the regions around the city or from overseas. So there's fundamental differences there. Also, again, a lot of cities focus on a river that's going through the city or docks or something like that, or beaches. And so, again, they've all got differences. And again, some are heavily reliant on tourism and others might be industrial hubs or something like that. So I was very conscious. I was in Thailand after the 9/11 issue in the US, and there were not many tourists around. And I was quite shocked at how desperate so many of the people selling cards and food items and things like that on the streets were, because the tourism economy had collapsed. And of course, COVID showed the same kind of thing. So you see there, some cities are incredibly dependent on lots of people wanting to come and visit them, which means you've got to have interesting things for them to do and see to keep attracting them, but people will come. And one of my RMIT university colleagues is touring around Europe at the moment. He's complaining about all these tourists, but there's plenty of room for variety.
I'm asking this because sometimes I hear architects and urban planners ruminate over the sorrow that each and every city has the same three fast food restaurant franchises. You go through a street and you see the same companies, same brands, and nothing special remains in that specific area. That's why it was really interesting that you started your answer with cities are varied and their future will be varied. Yeah.
Well, what you were touching into there is something that I really started thinking about again when I was in this APEC low carbon model town work in Nui, tourism area in Thailand, where there was a really vibrant roadside shopping, food provision culture. And then we were taken to a new area which solved the problem of the dangers of tourists being run over by cars and motorbikes and things like that with the roadside shopping. But it was built in a way that cut out the low-income family living behind the roadside shop, which to me is very much a pathway out of poverty towards a better life for a lot of those people. And what appeared was spaces and shops and things like that that were more going to work for the multinational businesses. So I think there's choice here. And again, it comes back to the point that, well, first of all, you can have some of both. But I think one of the interesting things with the roadside shops and things like that was that one of the things the council and the government people were concerned about was pedestrian safety. Well, you can solve that by taking everyone away from the roads or slowing the people down on the roads or shifting people away from cars and big trucks and things like that to more human scale mobility solutions. And again, that's one of the big innovations we're seeing is the electric bike, the electric scooter, the small electric freight vehicle for the last kilometer transport and things like that. So that again, I think where we're going, there will be more options, and the challenge will be to recognize things like, gee, we've just set up this big shopping mall thing, and oh yeah, all the shops in it are multinational brands, and that's taking away some of our value as a tourism destination, and also it's taking away the pathways towards, well, away from poverty. So I think there are choices that are being made, but I think a lot of them are being made without actually consciously realizing the impacts that you're having. And that's where the reverse of that is when we see the regreening of cities and things like that. I stayed one night in Paris a while ago, and I got to walk along the Linear Park, which was the old railway line, and it had been turned into a fabulous thing. And I wandered along, and then I just went off down and found a nice little cafe and It's a real asset to the city. And again, we've seen that with some other cities where people have demolished the freeway that was running along the waterfront and transformed the viability of the city. So again, certainly in a lot of cities, the transformation away from the assumption that everyone will not only be able to afford a car, but will want to use it, is transformed. And certainly friends of mine who may have previously had two cars now have a car and a couple of electric bikes. And the electric bike is a far more efficient shopping device than a car because you don't have to find a car park. I think we do. We have increasing choice. But the challenge then when you have choice is how do you make a good choice? And that's maybe where we've got to do a lot more work.
Then what are the three biggest fears or concerns regarding the future of cities for you?
Instead of fears and concerns, I'd like to reframe them as maybe risks and challenges, because that's got the same tone, I think. So clearly for me, global heating is a real concern and a real challenge for every city, and particularly in hotter regions and things like that, or areas that are low-lying. And look, I was in the UK in 2017, 2018, just before COVID, there were bushfires in Northern Europe and people were a bit shocked even then at the temperatures that we were having. A friend of mine's in Turkey at the moment. He's fled to the mountains of Italy to find somewhere cool. And this is going to have deep impact because, for example, in some Asian cities now, there's real concern that we're getting close to 35 degree wet bulb temperatures. So that's not dry bulb temperature. Dry bulb temperature is what a normal thermometer does. Wet bulb temperature is you have the thermometer wrapped in a damp cloth. You're measuring the sort of 100% humidity temperature. And essentially, the science is pretty clear now that if you are in sustained times of 35 degrees wet bulb temperature, your body stops working properly, basically. And we are seeing increasing numbers of places that are getting into that space. And this is without much warming. Also, we're going to see increasing challenges for anyone who works outside or who can't get active cooling to get their body temperature down overnight. And again, if we look at Europe, so many areas in Europe have heavyweight buildings that are not well insulated and don't understand what shading is for. So once you have a sustained hot spell, they are really ovens. And again, even without that, a lot of modern buildings, when I was in the UK, I had the dubious honour of having a west-facing hotel room in Manchester, which the whole wall was glass. And yes, it was advanced glass, but advanced glass isn't that good. And so basically that room was uninhabitable from about 1 o'clock in the afternoon till about 4 o'clock, when luckily the sun went behind the building across the road. So we've actually got a lot of infrastructure that is not designed to cope with the combination of extreme heat and winter. And in fact, it's been interesting for me as someone who's doing work on heat pumps and stuff like that, that like in Australia, we all have what we call reverse cycle air conditioners, which can heat and cool. But a lot of the focus in Europe on heat pumps is just about heating systems. And people are not taking the opportunity to put in systems that will actually provide both heating and cooling, because they're going to need it. A lot of them need it already. So there's going to be a lot of wasted money, I think, upgrading and going off gas for certain reasons to high efficiency electric technology. But I don't think people are necessarily planning for what summers will be like in a lot of Europe. And again, it'll be a combination of reducing emissions by electrifying and efficiency and smart management and distributed energy and all those things, as well as adapting to deal with the climate extremes. I think another risk is equity. And I see the equity issue as not just local, but global, of course. For example, at a local level, it's pretty clear. And in a way, talking about the roadside shops and things like that's an element of equity in the sense that we want people to be empowered to be able to improve themselves and to have decent accommodation and things like that. So that's all at the local level to have meaningful work. But again, with climate change, we're now seeing a lot of people beginning to be displaced to other areas. So we're going to see conflicts. And one of the slides that I use in my lectures is a slide that shows that even in a lot of developing countries, there are quite a lot of very rich people. And there are quite a lot of poor people, a lot more of them, of course. And so one of the challenges we have is how do we overcome the massive inequities that are all over the place at the moment if we're going to have success? Because I think one of the challenges you have is that if you're on the wrong end of the equity scale, you can get angry if you feel no one's taking any notice of you. And that's something that can cause real problems in a city with a lack of personal safety and security, challenges to the governance structures and all sorts of things like that. So I think that the whole equity issue is going to be enormous. And certainly, again, Australia is based in the Pacific region. And for example, a lot of people in the Pacific Islands are very grumpy about Australia because we keep digging up more fossil fuels and selling them to someone else. And because of the disastrous structure of carbon accounting, Australia doesn't have to take any responsibility for the emissions from the burning of the fossil fuels that we export. And actually, on the other side of it, quite quirky, I was involved in looking at the environmental impact of Barbie dolls recently. But of course, most of the emissions associated with production of a Barbie doll happen in China and Mexico. And so again, Australians who buy a Barbie doll don't have to take responsibility for the environmental impacts of a lot of the things we're buying. So there's a whole lot of equity issues that are not being worked out well at the moment. But I think that's where digitalization and data analytics and a whole lot of things like that are making it much more possible to track what's going on and to ask the questions about who should take some responsibility or most responsibility or whatever. And I think there'll be a new level of accountability. And I think that's where in the carbon space, what we're seeing, I don't know how familiar your listeners are, but there are scope one, scope two, and scope three carbon emissions in the accounting systems. And scope one, your direct combustion and waste emissions that are on your site and that you control. Scope two are the emissions in the energy that you buy in. So they're the emissions from the electricity production at the coal-fired power station I have to take responsibility for. And the scope three emissions are basically for everything else that I influence. And so, for example, I've recently been doing work with the food industry, and the food retailers are starting to realize that most of the emissions in the food system are actually not in their shop. They are in all the whole supply chain. And so they are starting to write clauses into their contracts for the inputs to start saying, look, I want you to document your emissions and show us how you're cutting them. And that's where internationally, particularly the Science Based Target Initiative, which is really one of the main credible carbon accounting schemes for voluntary action, they are now requiring large businesses where their scope three emissions are more than, I think, 40% of their emissions to have to report on their scope three emissions. So this is not just your inputs, but it's actually the impact of what you're selling as well. And there's increasing pressure for you to act. And so they're starting to say, well, tell us not only what your scope three emissions are, but what are you doing to make a difference? So I think this whole issue of accountability is going to change a lot, and that's going to influence everything. As an example there, in Australia, we have an interesting buyers alliance called MECLA, Materials, Energy and Carbon Leaders, a Buyers Alliance. MECLA is the right acronym. I haven't got it quite right. But what's happening there is that they are developing model specifications for green products, mainly green building products. And basically, there are a bunch of big buyers, like big construction companies and governments and things building infrastructure. And they're basically saying to the supply chain, look, if you meet these specifications, we'll buy your product. So I think these are the really deep changes that are going on.
Could you please describe what equity means to you?
It's not necessarily equal outcomes. There's two sides to equity. One is for you to have reasonable expectations and to not assume that everyone needs a Rolls Royce or something. One is to have reasonable expectations, and the second thing is to have a reasonable opportunity for those expectations to be met. And at a basic level, you can talk about Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, starting off with basic safety and survival, right up to your spiritual needs and your self-actualization needs. And again, that's not directly linked to financial things at all. Once you've got your basic things covered, it's really very much linked to your culture and your philosophy. And I think that's one thing that was interesting. Some years ago, a team led by Michael Grubb in the UK did an analysis of the carbon emissions per capita for a whole lot of different countries. And what they found was that, yes, to go from extreme poverty to a modest, simple lifestyle did require some more energy. But once you got to quite a low level of energy use or emissions per capita, after that, all of the different economies were all over the place on the graph. And so it's possible to have a really high emission intensity, relatively poor economy where people are not doing well on per capita GDP. And it's possible to have one that's got fantastically low emissions and high quality of life. And this is where we start to unravel how important the efficiency of our energy and resource use is. Because if we're really smart, like in my city, you can build a house that needs virtually no heating or cooling, or you can build one that will cost you thousands and thousands of dollars a year to heat and cool. And if the cooling and heating fails, you are not comfortable. So that's the point. How we do things matters a lot.
Which brings back to a question I wanted to ask. What is efficiency for you?
Efficiency is maximizing the amount of useful service that you get relative to whatever indicators you want to consider. And typically that might be the cost of capturing, getting that service, but also the resource impacts that it might be. We're actually having this debate in Australia at the moment because our energy market's designed with what they call economic efficiency in mind. And yet the national energy objective actually says, as well as efficiency, which they don't define what that efficiency means, it's meant to be acting in the long-term interests of consumers. Now, we don't have a carbon price in our energy market. So for starters, as far as I'm concerned, we're not looking at the long-term interests of consumers. But all of the economists who run the energy system think they're being terrific because they're using pricing signals to shift demand around and reward people when there's scarcity so they'll build more power stations. And it's, oh, we've got a very economically efficient system that doesn't work very well at all. Efficiency is in the eye of the beholder, I think.
So the three biggest risks and challenges were global heating and equity, locally and globally, and accountability.
Yeah, I think there are things I'm concerned about. I'd probably add pollution and its links to health as maybe up there with them, because that's one of the basics, isn't it? And we're not doing very well on that in cities. And I think, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, I think we have fantastic opportunity to dramatically improve health and reduce pollution impacts for city dwellers.
So what are the three biggest opportunities regarding the future of cities for you?
Starting off, say, in the energy space, as I said before, we're undergoing a revolution. We are transforming the extent to which people can be empowered to have a better life by using less energy, by producing their own energy, by storing it, by managing it. So I think that's an enormous opportunity. And what's interesting to me there is that there's a real discontinuity in this, because if you, again, look at Australia, a typical Australian household or business, only maybe 3 or 4% of their input costs are stationary energy for heating, cooling, lighting, and everything they want to do except transport. But that stationary energy production is half of Australia's greenhouse gas emissions. So one of the key issues we have to face here with this is that there's a dissonance, because we can't massively increase the price of energy to a point where it would match half of our input costs, can we? So therefore, we're going to have to use a whole lot of policy tools and innovation techniques and things like that that don't necessarily get driven by price, because even if we doubled the price of energy, it wouldn't break the bank for most people. Again, you have their exceptions. We know that 10% of Australian households are paying a lot more than a few percent for their energy. But fundamentally, for most people, they would be able to adjust over a period of time. If you double the price of energy, that doesn't mean they would actually reduce their emissions, because energy is a sort of small component. And that's where the scope 3 emissions thing is quite interesting for businesses because, for example, if you take a supermarket in Australia, their energy costs are quite small. But every item of food that they are buying, about 10% or so of its cost to the shop is energy. But it's masked because they just pay a price for the product. They don't actually get the breakdown of what the components of carbon emissions energy are. And again, this is where digitalization and connection means we are increasingly able to actually explain to someone about those upstream costs. Likewise, a supermarket doesn't really pay much attention to the amount of money people have to spend to drive to the supermarket. So there's interesting questions here about, again, we come back to the issue of accountability, but also if we want to be successful in dealing with climate and transforming the energy system, we have to work out much better policy ways. So that's one. And I guess that's also included data and digitalization and connection and advanced data analytics to me are a really big opportunity. It's because people can become informed and empowered and also accountable if we start utilizing data systems in good ways. And that then leads to the other question of when you're doing all of this, what sorts of indicators do you use? And this is where, again, there are some countries now developing wellness indicators, for example. We can track health and, again, see the links between it. For example, an organisation called Sustainability Victoria, a government organisation, recently did a project in Melbourne where they upgraded the energy efficiency of the homes of a number of elderly people. But they tracked the indirect effects of that. And what they found was that the value of reduced healthcare costs was 10 times the size of the savings in energy bills. Now, a lot of those savings were actually being accrued by governments who fund health services. So that's the kind of thing that you can start to learn as we start to use better indicators, which we can use only because we've got better data and better analytics systems.
Coming back to the scope 3 emissions, how can we do this kind of accountability to making sure that I am responsible what I am emitting, even indirectly, without making life miserable and making people completely frozen that there is so much to pay attention to. I don't have the time, the resources, the effort, anything to really make a change in my life and still being able to live my life how I want it.
I think this is the key thing, is that data and information are only inputs to behavior. So, for example, we did some work on what we call the food value chain in Australia for an organization called the Race for 2030 Cooperative Research Center. And what we found was that once you can start to track where there's waste, you can then look at the implications of that waste for everyone. So, for example, if a truck driver has a key performance indicator to save fuel and chooses to do that by switching off the refrigeration equipment in his truck, which does happen, then all of the people downstream will have more food waste. There will be less money to pay the farmer and the people upstream because, let's say, 10% of the food that could have been sold to make money has actually cost money to get rid of. So that's where one of the things about this accountability is that you can start to look at where the issues are, where the opportunities are, and you can also share responsibility because if the food is well looked after in the supply chain, the retailer will have a longer shelf life for the food, which means they will save labor. They will also not have to dispose of so much waste, so they will have a lower waste cost. So there are benefits that can be quantified so that a supermarket can say, look, it's in my interest to help you have a better insulated truck with a refrigeration system that's cheaper to run and maybe an electric truck so your trucking fuel costs are much lower, right? So this is the point. We have a choice. Once we understand what's happening along the whole system, we can choose to abuse people and bully them to make them change. Or we can say, well, actually, if the truck driver changes and the truck has changed, I will benefit. So it's in my interest to help them change. And again, one of the things we find in the food system in Australia is that the supermarkets are very big and very powerful, but a lot of the businesses in the whole food system are small businesses or micro businesses even. They don't have lots of capital. They don't have a long time horizon. So again, they're not necessarily in a position to change by themselves unless someone helps them. So until you know what's going on, you can't get the government to subsidize the right people or the downstream consumers to help them or require them to get trained and then someone set up the training for them. So all of these things only come once you've got this sort of intricate understanding of what's going on. But it is open to abuse. It's like everything. Everything's a two-edged sword, opportunity and threat.
I understand that the first step is knowing what's happening. How can we help the specific decision makers to consider these second and third grade benefits and disadvantages? How can you and I, or just one normal member of the audience without any special knowledge, help these decision makers understand that we want these kind of disruptive changes?
It may not be the individual's responsibility. I think this is where it's interesting to look at emerging business models. So, for example, the circular economy model. The circular economy model has synergies with scope 3 carbon emissions tracking, because essentially what I'm trying to do if I'm in a circular economy system is I'm trying to minimize the waste I produce. But the waste that I do produce, I want someone else to perceive to be a valuable resource. So they'll buy it off me instead of it costing me to dump. So there are ways to develop the synergies. But again, as I said, like the supermarket doesn't see the cost of energy that's embodied in their product. Likewise, a home buyer doesn't recognize that actually there's going to be about half a dozen households live in this house over its life, and the decisions they're making about how the house is built will impact on all those people. And this is where, again, simple things like a lot of countries now have energy disclosure at the time of sale or lease of buildings. And that means a consumer can say, I want a building with low bills and a long life. And the information is publicly available. And that works. There's been studies that show that, for example, energy disclosure or lots of disclosure solutions at the time of sale can have a virtuous circle, because if consumers are then informed and governments promote the program properly and it's designed so people can understand it, consumer pressure then starts to appear. And the builder of the house says, oh, I can probably sell this house for a bit more than I could have otherwise if I just do a few things differently. So you then get the market working to optimize the cost effectiveness of doing a good building that allows them to get a good rating, that then means people will pay a bit more or will be more likely to go to them because of comfort or other benefits. And so then you get the cycle, because then once the thing is on the market, the second or third or fourth time, the rating can be reinforced again at that time. And so the person who's bought the house is likely to be able to sell it for more. And so you get the whole system starting to work the right way. And in Australia, we've got a commercial building rating scheme called NABERS, the Nationwide Australian Building Environment Rating. That has been amazing. That has achieved over 40% energy savings in the commercial sector where it's been applied. And it started off as a voluntary program in one state of Australia. It is now a national program. And one of the key drivers has actually been government saying, we don't want to rent or buy a building that's less than 4.5 or 5 stars in NABERS. So that's put pressure from a big consumer on the building industry. But a lot of the building management companies really like NABERS because it's based on actual performance, actual consumption of energy and water. And also we've had introduced a mandatory energy disclosure of your NABERS rating at the time of sale or lease of your property. So essentially that mechanism has worked really well. And as I say, I think they're claiming 43% savings or something And they're also neighbours are now documenting the progressive improvements so that what they're seeing is that once a building starts to get neighbours ratings, it tends to get ongoing improvements in performance over time as well. So there's an education, an awareness, and a motivation. And one of the reasons for that is because the neighbours' ratings got to be displayed in the foyer. So you think if you're a tenant or the owner of the building, you know a whole lot of senior managers are going to be walking past that, as well as a lot of the clients of the people who rent there. So there's a sort of a feel-good factor that influences things like that. And I think that's where I find a lot of people in the energy and material spaces really don't seem to understand how to motivate people and how to empower people. We have to do much better at that than we have done.
It was very reassuring to hear that you started with the economic benefits, that these disruptive changes are producing economic benefits for the consumer and for the client who will require these changes because of these economic benefits. And the feel-good factor just came in with the last sentence, because that means that we are not waiting for the developers to please be a good guy, but they have economic incentives to do that.
Yeah. And a good example is that Australia has a national building code for the residential sector, which is way behind on energy disclosure, I tell you. But anyway, that's another story. But we have just, the regulations have just been strengthened from what was called a 6-star rating to a 7-star rating, which, by the way, would still not be legal in quite a bit of Europe. But hey, it's better. But the only reason we really got that through against the incumbent traditional industry opposition was because the health sector and the social justice sector have really, in the last few years, realised how important good performing homes are. And for example, I was at one of the workshops where a representative from the multiple sclerosis side was there. And he said, well, if the house gets too hot, people with MS, their bodies can't control their temperature. So we really need good houses that work well in summer. So we're here demanding higher star ratings. It was hard to make a financial case just based on energy savings. But as soon as the social justice and health people started talking to their politicians, we got 7 stars. So again, it's a matter of helping people understand what's causing their problems, because a lot of people are not very good at analysing what's good or bad about something. And we need more help to understand those things. So a good example here, it's not really an urban issue, but it's about air fryers. I started noticing a lot of people waxing eloquent about their air fryers being really fast and nice, tasty food, and the kids will eat it and things like that. And so I did some analysis which showed that they actually were about 50% more efficient than an oven, as long as you didn't have to cook 3 batches to one oven. But then I was running a workshop for energy efficiency consultants, and I asked them, okay, who's got an air fryer? And quite a few put up their hand. I said, okay, why did you buy it? Not one of these energy efficiency experts mentioned that it was because they were more energy efficient. It was all about the kids or the tasty chips or all these other reasons that I was pointing out to them. Like, people need a translation of the energy or climate narrative to things that they can relate to. And so I wrote an article about why does an air fryer do all these good things for you? It's because it's been very well designed and it's doing things in a way that a normal oven can't. And this is the same, my view on energy efficiency more broadly, is that energy efficiency reframes reality. You know, if you had a traditional television the size of a TV today, you'd need a crane to put it in your lounge room and it would take up a fair bit of space, right? Likewise, your mobile phone is a supercomputer. We used to take all night to run one building simulation that takes less than a second now. So efficiency and optimization of performance are really important. But in fact, most people are simply not aware of how the different things play out. And I see this in industry all the time, where you can show a business that more than half of their energy that they're using is happening when no one's working in the factory. There are ways of starting to highlight to people how you could do things differently by pointing out things in the right ways. And that's why I've developed, you know, quite a few web-based calculators and all sorts of things like that, because people will overemphasize some things. Like a lot of people worry about lights being left on more than they probably should now that we have really efficient LED lights. But that's because they're visible. Whereas the faulty fridge that is actually not even keeping their food properly is using three or four times as much electricity as a properly operating efficient fridge. In many ways, we consumers wear blindfolds because we don't get the feedback from our appliances. For example, one of the most common reasons for call-outs for air conditioners to be repaired in Australia is because people have not cleaned the filter. So they're paying $150 for someone to come and clean the filter that you just open the lid and vacuum. But they don't know. In fact, a lot of them don't even know their air conditioner has a filter. And we have failed to communicate to them that this is something that matters and it's actually quite easy to do. And if you're a bit frail, you can get your grandson or the next door neighbor to do it for you, you know? So these are, I find it really fascinating how little most people understand about how much better their lives could be if they did a few smart things. It's because we're very bad at educating people about it, actually.
What are you excited about regarding the future of cities?
Going back to what I was saying at the start, I think we have the tools and the technologies to make a lot of people's urban lives much better, to spend less time traveling, to have fewer people killed and injured on the roads, to potentially recognize things like the importance of roadside shops as a pathway out of poverty. So we have lots of things to do. And at the same time, we're getting really strong focus on regreening cities and making cities nice places to be, which is really great. I'm excited about the opportunity. There are also really smart business techniques and things people are doing. So, for example, apparently in some parts of, it might be India, people are struggling to buy an electric bike or an electric tuk to run a business because the battery is so expensive. So what they're doing is they're selling those vehicles without a battery and they're setting up battery swapping facilities. So you can basically buy a battery full of electricity to run your little tuk-tuk or your delivery bike or whatever. And because you've got the cash flow from the income or you've got a cost that's low enough at a given time for you to be able to afford it, you can now have your electric bike or electric vehicle without that big upfront cost of a battery. So these are the kinds of interesting business models that are emerging. And in fact, there was another example on a website for developing countries where, again, with all the smarts we've got, they are going into a community and establishing a central refrigeration system that runs on solar and all the works. And because you've got tags and monitoring and all of that, people can pay to have a crate full of food stored for a week. And again, it's a modest amount of money that they can budget for instead of this problem of having to find the capital cost to buy your own fridge. So I think these are the sorts of models that are really transforming our capacity to allow people to get access to services that are really important to them. And in the case of that refrigeration, you are reducing your food waste. So your total cost of living are probably going down. So these are the kinds of exciting things to me as we understand things better and do things better and are more creative about the way we promote them instead of heavy-handed regulation to get people to do something they don't really know why they're being made to do it. You turn all of that around, I think, with the emerging solutions that we have. So that's pretty exciting to me. It keeps me busy. I learn new stuff every day. That also excites me. So as I say, I learned a lot about air fryers by talking to people and then looking at the laws of physics as they applied.
This ingenuity instead of regulation is really interesting. Do you say this is ingenuity or innovation?
I probably don't really distinguish between the two because in a sense, what you're doing is you are looking at people's perceived reality and unraveling it to discover where things could be done better. And at the same time, you are constantly having to look at what the new technologies that are emerging are that you could utilize So it's about understanding where the waste is, if you like, and where you're not getting the service you want. And then it's a matter of tracking down the right technologies. To give an example of the sort of enabling technology that's coming, a lot of construction equipment uses what they call hydraulic rams, which use high-pressure oil to push a piston to move, to dig the dirt up or whatever. They're inefficient, dangerous, they leak oil, and they're clunky. So there's a spin-off business from MIT in the US called Rise Robotics, who have developed an electric equivalent of the hydraulic ram that is much lighter, has no oils and things like that, and is very flexible because it's electric motor driven, and it is able to be connected into your data system so you can track what it's doing. And if something's failing or if the machine driver's doing something stupid or whatever, it can provide data, but it can also take signals from data from other places. So, for example, let's say you could have some sensors saying, oh, look, the soil quality is different here. You can take bigger bites out of with your digger. There's all sorts of stuff you can do once you've got this flexibility and the information. And again, it's not just data. It's transforming data into meaningful information that relates to what you're doing. And I think this is the key thing, is like a lot of energy consultants spend a lot of money putting in energy monitoring and all that, but they don't actually tap into all of the multiple data streams, like what was the weather like when we used a lot of energy, or what was happening when we were hardly using any energy, what were we doing right? It may well be that, you know, one operator's really good at doing efficient operation and the other one's not so good. So the good one can teach the other one to do better, or they can. You can turn that around and make it a bad outcome and abuse the person who's not doing the right things, but who doesn't know how to do it differently. So all of these things have swings and roundabouts, but I think there's all that potential.
You mentioned a few times smarts. What does smartness mean to you?
Well, smart means you are able to access information and unravel its meaning so that you can then understand what's going on and what could go on, thinking about what is the potential here, and then coming up with a solution that will work and that meets the cost barriers and the technology barriers and the human barriers and all of those things, so that you get an outcome that someone will value. And this is where, in across like not just food, but building and things like that, I keep talking about value chains. And the big difference for me between a value chain and a supply chain is the value chain includes the end consumer and requires people to ask, what services does the consumer think they're getting? What are they really getting? And is that what they really want? And that shifts the balance. And also, you then point out to the whole supply chain that pretty much all the money that they are sharing amongst themselves and fighting over is coming from the end consumer. And most of those individual businesses don't even think about the end consumer. They think about their immediate customer being happy. And they are assuming that your immediate customer knows what the next customer to them wants. And it's like, actually, we've got these massive information failures at every interface within a value chain. And so the opportunity for savings and for better performance and happier people and all of those things is enormous and far bigger than most people realize. That's what kind of keeps me going.
That's amazing that with your thinking, you involve even the end user, not just the next customer in the whole chain. Ellen, you have been very generous with your time. What is your role in establishing the future of cities?
Having podcasts like these where I can spread my knowledge, and obviously I teach. And I have been lucky enough to be involved in designing some appliances and things like that. And I do quite a lot in green building and those areas. So I guess my role is to try to drive change. We've just been doing a lot of work on aquatic centres in Australia, where our aquatic centres are appallingly inefficient with high gas bills at the moment. Everyone is really interested in change. I'm lucky because I've got a technical background, but I've also been an educator and a communication manager and things like that, and a consultant and a public servant. And I actually came into the energy and industry space from the community movement. So I've always had the community as a focus and the end user of anything as a focus for me. And that means I just see the world differently from lots of different people. And I try to share that wherever I can with my writing, teaching, and practical examples, because people need practical examples that the impossible can be possible. So all of those things are what I do. Time I look after my grandkids.
Thank you so much for doing this kind of information spreading, because it's really important, and experts can forget that the usual customer will not understand what the first rate benefits are and need to translate the second and third rate benefits as well. Do you have any closing comments or requests for the audience?
One specific thing that's been interesting me at the moment, very specific within developing countries, is that in many developing countries, people have small generators because the electricity grid is very unreliable. And if you're running a business, you've got to keep the food right and do things. And I've been looking at them because in Australia, we've had a lot of people buying these small generators because we've had big bushfires and floods and the grid has failed. And what I found was that they're incredibly inefficient. And there's very little information about their real efficiency. But when they're running at part load, they are costing like 5 or 10 times as much as normal electricity per unit of electricity. They're shocking, and they're polluting and noisy and dangerous, and we should be transforming them. I could not find, I looked in the developing country technology literature, I didn't see anyone doing any work on optimizing efficiency of small generators or replacing the need for them or limiting the need for them by giving people access to batteries and things like that, which is why that battery swapping idea that's being used for electric vehicles could be used for households and all sorts of different reasons. So that's a very specific thing I would like people to think about.
Perfect. That's the most specific anyone have ever asked my audience, but it's amazing. Thank you so much.
I look forward to someone developing the solution and making a lot of money out of it and saving a lot of air pollution and carbon emissions and money.
Thank you so much, Alan.
My pleasure.
It was really interesting to hear from Alan, his description of energy efficiency reframing reality. Not to mention his praise for circular economy, Nicola Garofano introduced circular economy in detail in episode 171. You can find out more about Alan online, all the links are in the show notes. What was the most interesting part for you? What questions did arise regarding Alan's approach to the future of cities? What have you learned from this interview? Let me know on Twitter at WTF4Cities or on the WTF4Cities.com website, where the transcripts and show notes are available. You can also subscribe on the website not to miss any new episodes and leave some feedback. I hope this was an interesting interview for you as well, and thanks for tuning in.
What is the future for cities podcast?